this as a mad dog among sheep. What she couldn't figure out, though, was how he'd tracked her down. Had he decided to settle here and been waiting for her, or for somebody who might have seen the glass ring? Anna had said that Mr. Welcome had only been there a couple of days, but then again, he could have been living in Mary's Rest in any number of disguises. However and whenever he'd arrived, Mr. Welcome had to be found. And Jean and Zachiel had gone looking for him armed to the teeth. He was here, Josh remembered Swan saying, the man with the scarlet eye.
Should we send somebody to find them? Sister asked.
What? He came back from his thoughts.
Jean and Zachiel, should we start looking for them?
No, not yet. He'd wanted to go with them, but Glory had grasped his sleeve and said he needed to stay near Swan. She knows what he is, Josh had thought, and maybe she was trying to save his life, too. The man with the scarlet eye, he said softly. Huh? Robin frowned, not knowing if he'd heard correctly. That's what Swan calls him. He didn't tell the boy that the lettering on that particular tarot card had read, The Devil.
Right, Robin scoffed.
You two must have some strong medicine stashed around here, big dude. I wish. Josh decided that Robin was okay. A little rough around the edges, of course, but wasn't everybody these days. I'm going to get a cup of coffee. You can go in, but you can only stay for 2 minutes. Understand? He waited until the boy nodded, and then he went to the front room. The entrance to where Swan lay sleeping was unblocked. But Robin hesitated. His palms were clammy. By the lamplight, he could make out a figure lying on the cot. A blanket was pulled up to her chin, but her face was averted, and he couldn't see it.
Go on, Sister told him.
I'm scared shitless, he realized.
What did you mean? She's changed.
Is she, you know, messed up?
Go in and see for yourself.
His feet refused to budge.
She's pretty important, isn't she?
I mean, if she made the corn start growing again, she must really be somebody special, right?
You'd better go in. You're wasting your 2 minutes.
She gave him a shove, and he entered the bedroom. Sister followed him. Robin walked to the side of the bed. He was as nervous as if he was about to get his hands whacked by one of the nuns for throwing spitballs. He saw a spill of golden hair on the patchwork pillow. It shone in the lamplight like newly mown hay, but it was flecked here and there with hints of red. His knees bumped the edge of the bed. He was entranced by that hair. He'd forgotten what clean hair looked like. And then she shifted position under the blanket and turned onto her back, and Robin saw her face. She was still sleeping, her features peaceful. Her hair flowed back like a mane from her high, unlined forehead, and streaks of red coursed through the hair at her temples like flames in a yellow field. She had an oval-shaped face, and she was... Yes, Robin thought, yes. She was beautiful. The most beautiful girl he'd ever seen. Reddish-blonde brows made crescents over her closed eyes. She had a straight, elegant nose and sharp cheekbones, and in her chin was a small, star-shaped cleft. Her skin was very pale, almost translucent. Its hue reminded Robin of what the moon had looked like on a clear summer night in the world that used to be. Robin's gaze wandered over her face, but timidly, like someone exploring a lovely garden where there's no path. He wondered what she'd look like awake, what color her eyes would be, what her voice would sound like, how her lips would move. His eyes couldn't get enough of her. She looked like the daughter of a marriage between ice and fire. Wake up, he thought. Please wake up. She lay sleeping and still, but something awakened within himself.
Wake up, Swan, he wished.
Her eyes remained closed. A voice jarred his rapture.
Josh! Glory! Come out here and look at this!
It was that old bat Anna, he realized, calling from the front door. He returned his attention to Swan.
Let me see what's going on, Sister said. I'll be right back.
She left the room, but Robin had hardly heard her. He reached out to touch Swan's cheek, but stopped himself. He didn't feel clean enough to touch her. His clothes were tattered and stiff with sweat and grime, and his hands were dirty. Anna was right about his hair looking like a bird's nest. Why the hell had he ever wanted to braid feathers and bones in his hair, he wondered. It had been something to do, he guessed. And at the time, he'd thought it was pretty cool. Now, he just felt dumb.
Wake up, Swan, he whispered.
There was still no response. A fly suddenly dropped down, hovering above her face, and Robin snatched it in his fist and crushed it against his leg, because a filthy thing like that had no business in here with her. The insect stung his skin just a little bit, but he barely noticed. He stood staring down at her face and thinking of all the things he'd ever heard about love.
Man, he thought, the guys sure would howl if they could see me right now. But she was so beautiful that he thought his heart might crack.
Sister would be back at any second. If he was going to do what he yearned to, he would have to do it fast.
Wake up, he whispered again.
And when she still didn't move, he lowered his head and lightly kissed the corner of her mouth. The warmth of her lips under his own shocked him, and he caught the aroma of her skin like a faint breeze through a peach orchard. His heart was hammering like a heavy metal drum beat, but he let the kiss linger, and linger, and linger. Then he ended it, scared to death that Sister or one of the others would barge in. That big dude would boot him so high and far he could hitch a ride on a satellite. If any of those were still up the... Swan moved. Robin was sure of it. Something had moved. An eyebrow, the corner of her mouth, maybe a twitch of the cheek or jaw. He leaned over her, his face only a few inches from hers. Her eyes opened without warning. He was so startled, he jerked his head back as if she were a statue coming to life. Her eyes were dark blue, flecked with red and gold, and their colors made him think of the glass ring. She sat up, one hand fluttering to her lips where the kiss had lingered. And then Robin saw her pale cheeks bloom vivid pink. She lifted her right hand, and before Robin could think to duck, a stinging slap was delivered to the side of his face. He staggered back a few feet before he caught himself. His own cheek was reddening now, but he managed a goofy grin. He could think of nothing better to say than, "Hi." Swan stared at her hands, touched her face, ran her fingers along her nose, across her mouth, felt the ridges of her cheekbones and the line of her jaw. She was shaking and about to cry, and she didn't know who the boy with feathers and bones in his hair was, but she'd hit him because she'd thought he was about to attack her. Everything was confused and crazy, but she had a face again, and she could see clearly through both eyes. She caught a glint of reddish gold from the corner of her eye, and she took a long strand of her own hair between her fingers. She stared at it as if she wasn't sure what the stuff was. The last time she'd had hair, she remembered, was on the day she and her mama had walked into that dusty grocery store in Kansas. "My hair used to be pale blonde," she recalled. "Now, it was the color of fire."
"I can see," she told the boy, as tears slid down her smooth cheeks. "I can see again."
Her voice, without the Job's mask pressing at her mouth and nostrils,
was different, too. It was the soft, smoky voice of a girl on the edge of being a woman. And now her voice strained with excitement as she called, "Josh! Josh!" Robin ran out to get Sister with the image of the most beautiful girl he'd ever seen stamped like a cameo into his brain. But Sister wasn't in the front room. She was standing at the foot of the porch steps, along with Glory and Paul. Josh and Anna stood on either side of Aaron, about 35 feet from the porch and almost dead center in the road. Aaron was the focus of rapt attention.
"See?" he crowed. "I told you it was magic. You just gotta know how to hold it."
The two small branches that jutted off at opposite angles from Crybaby were balanced on the tips of Aaron's forefingers. The dowsing rod's other end was going up and down, like the action of a pump. Aaron grinned proudly at his magic trick, all eyes and shining teeth, as more people gathered around.
"I do believe you might have found us a well," Josh said wonderingly.
"Huh?"
Aaron asked as Crybaby continued to point the way to fresh water. At the steps, Sister felt a hand grip her shoulder. She turned and saw Robin standing there. He was trying to speak, but he was so flustered he couldn't get the words out. She saw the splayed red handprint on his cheek, and she was about to push him aside and run into the shack when Swan came through the doorway. The blanket wrapped around her tall, thin body and her legs as uncertain as a fawn's. She squinted and blinked in the dim gray light. Sister could have been knocked over by a snowflake, and then she heard Robin whisper, "Oh!" as if he'd been physically struck, and she knew. Anna looked up from the bobbing dowsing rod. Josh turned around and saw what the others had already seen. He took one step, a second, and a third, and then he broke into a run that would have bowled even Haystack's Muldoon flat on his back. The people who'd gathered around scrambled out of his way. He bounded up the steps, and Swan was already reaching out for him and just about to fall. He swept her off her feet before she tumbled, and he squeezed her to his chest and thought, thank God my daughter's come back." He sank his deformed head against her shoulder and began to cry, and Swan heard it not as a hurting sound this time, but as a song of newfound joy. Part 12. True Faces. Mr. Caden's Son, a visit with the Savior, a lady, storming the fortress. The Lair. Chapter 70. Swan walked amid the rows of green and growing corn stalks as flurries of snow hissed upon the bonfires. Josh and Sister walked on either side of her, and they were flanked by two men with rifles who kept a sharp lookout for bobcats or any other kind of predator. It had been 3 days since Swan's awakening. Her slender body was warmed by a patchwork coat of many colors that Glory had sewn for her, and her head was protected by a white knit cap, one of dozens of gifts that the grateful people of Mary's Rest left for her on Glory's front porch. She couldn't use all the coats, gloves, pairs of socks, and caps that were offered, so the excess clothing went into cardboard boxes to be distributed among those whose clothes were almost worn out. Her intense dark blue eyes with their flecks of red and gold took in the new corn stalks, which were now about 4 feet tall and beginning to turn a darker green. Around the edges of her cap, Swan's hair flowed back like flames. Her skin was still very pale, but her cheeks were reddened by the chill wind. Her face was bony, in need of food and filling out, but that would come later. Right now, all that occupied her attention was the corn. Bonfires burned across the field, and volunteers from Mary's Rest watched around the clock to keep away the bobcats, crows, and whatever else might try to destroy the corn stalks.
Every so often, another group of volunteers would come with buckets and dippers to offer fresh water from the new well that the pickaxes and shovels had hit 2 days before. The water's taste blossomed the memories of all who sipped it, reminding them of things half forgotten. The smell of clean, cold mountain air, the sweetness of Christmas candy, fine wine that had sat in a bottle for 50 years awaiting appreciation, and dozens of others, each unique and part of a happier life. Water was no longer melted from the radioactive snow, and people were already beginning to feel stronger, their sore throats, headaches, and other ailments starting to fade. Gene Scully and Zaccheo Epstein had never returned. Their bodies were still missing, and Sister was certain they were dead. And certain also that the man with the scarlet eye was still somewhere in Mary's Rest. Sister kept her leather satchel in a tighter grip than ever, but now she wondered if he'd lost interest in the ring and had shifted his attention to Swan. Sister and Josh had talked about what kind of creature the man with the scarlet eye might be. She didn't know if she believed in a horned and fork-tailed devil, but she knew well enough what evil was. If he'd searched for them for 7 years, that meant he didn't know everything. He might be cunning, and maybe his intuition was razor sharp, and maybe he could change his face as he pleased and burst people into flame with a touch. But he was flawed and dumb, and maybe his greatest weakness was that he thought himself so damned much smarter than human beings. Swan paused in her inspection, then approached one of the smaller corn stalks. Its fronds were still speckled with the dark red spots of blood her hands had shed. She took off one of her gloves and touched the thin stalk, felt the prickling sensation that began at her feet, moved up her legs to her spine, then through her arm and fingers into the plant like a low current of electricity. She thought of that sensation as normal ever since she was a child, but now she wondered if her entire body wasn't in a way like crybaby. She was receptive to and drew up power from the battery of the earth and could direct it through her fingers into seeds, trees, and plants. Maybe it was a whole lot more, and maybe she could never really understand what it was, but she could close her eyes and see again the wonderful scenes that the glass ring had shown her, and she knew what she must devote the rest of her life to doing. At Swan's suggestion, rags and old papers had been bundled around the bases of the stalks to keep the new roots as warm as possible. The hard dirt had been broken up with shovels and holes dug every 4 or 5 feet between the rows. Into these holes, clean water was poured, and if you listened hard and the wind was still, you could hear the earth gasping as it drank. Swan went on, stopping every so often to touch one of the stalks or bend down and knead the dirt between her fingers. It felt like sparks were jumping off her hands, but she was uncomfortable having so many people around her all the time, especially the men with the rifles. It was weird having people watch you and want to touch you and give you the clothes right off their backs. She'd never felt special, and she didn't feel special now either. Being able to make the corn grow was just something she could do, like Glory could sew the patchwork coat, and Paul could make the little printing press work again. Everybody had a talent, and Swan knew that this was hers. She walked on a few more feet, and then she knew someone was staring at her. She turned her head to look back toward Mary's Rest, and she saw him standing across the field, his shoulder-length brown hair blowing in the wind. Sister followed Swan's line of sight and saw him, too. She knew Robin Oakes had been following them all morning, but he wouldn't come any closer. In the past 3 days, he'd declined any offer to enter Glory's shack. He was content to sleep by the bonfire, and Sister noted with interest that he cleaned all the feathers and animal bones out of his hair. Sister glanced at Swan and saw her blush before she turned quickly away. Josh was occupied with watching the woods for bobcats, and he didn't notice the little drama. "Just like a man," Sister mused, He can't see the forest for the trees.
They're doing fine, Swan told Sister to take her mind off Robin Oakes.
Her voice was nervous and a little higher pitched, and underneath the crust of her Job's mask, Sister smiled.
The fires are keeping the air warmer out here. I think the corn's doing just fine.
I'm glad to hear it, Sister answered.
Swan was satisfied. She went around to every bonfire, speaking to the volunteers, finding out if anyone needed to be replaced. If they wanted water or any of the root soup that Glory Anna or one of the other women was always cooking up. She made sure to thank them for helping watch the field and chase the circling crows away. Of course, the crows needed to eat too, but they'd have to find their own food somewhere else.
Swan noticed a teenage girl who had no gloves, and she gave her her own pair.
Dead skin was still flaking off Swan's palms, but otherwise, her hands had healed. She stopped at the plank of wood that marked Rusty's grave. She still didn't remember anything of that night but her dream of the man with the scarlet eye. There'd been no time to tell Rusty what he'd meant to her and how much she'd loved him. She remembered Rusty making red balls appear and disappear as part of the traveling show's magic act and earning an old can of beans or fruit cocktail for his work. The earth had him now, had folded strong arms around him so that he would sleep long and undisturbed, and his magic was still alive in her, in Josh, and in the green stalks that swayed in the wind with a promise of life yet to be. Swan, Josh, and Sister walked back across the field, accompanied by the two armed guards. Both Swan and Sister noted that Robin Oakes had already slipped away, and Swan felt a twinge of disappointment. Children hopped and jumped around Swan as they continued through the alleys toward Glory's shack. Sister's heart pounded as she watched every alley they passed for a sudden snake-like movement, and she thought she heard the squeak of red wagon wheels somewhere nearby. But the sound faded, and she wasn't sure if it had been there at all. A tall, gaunt man with pale blue keloids burned diagonally across his face was waiting for them, standing at the foot of the steps talking to Paul Thorson. Paul's hands were stained dark brown from the mud and dyes he and Glory were mixing to be used as ink for the bulletin sheet. There were dozens of people in the street and around the shack who'd come to catch a glimpse of Swan, and they made a path for her as she approached the waiting man. Sister stepped between them, tense and ready for anything, but she caught no repulsive, dank wave of cold coming off him, just body odor. His eyes were almost the same color as the keloids. He wore a thin cloth coat and his head was bare, tufts of black hair stuck up on a burned, scarred scalp.
"Mr. Caden's been waiting to see Swan," Paul said. "He's all right."
Sister immediately relaxed, trusting Paul's judgment.
"I think you should listen to what he says."
Caden turned his attention to Swan.
"My family and I live over there," he motioned in the direction of the burned-out church.
He had a flat Midwestern accent, and his voice was shaky but articulate.
"My wife and I have three boys. The oldest is 16, and up until this morning he had the same thing on his face that I understand you did."
He nodded toward Josh.
"Like that, those growths."
"The Job's mask," Sister said. "What do you mean, up until this morning?"
"Well, Ben was running a high fever. He was so weak he could hardly move, and then, early this morning, it just cracked open."
Sister and Swan looked at each other.
"I heard that yours did the same thing," Caden continued. "That's why I'm here. I know a lot of people must be wanting to see you, but could you come to my place and look at Ben?"
"I don't think there's anything Swan can do for your son," Josh said,
She's not a doctor. It's not that. Ben's fine. I thank God that stuff cracked open because he could barely draw a breath. It's just that... He looked at Swan again.
He's different, Caden said softly. Please, come see him. It won't take very long.
The need in the man's face moved her. She nodded, and they followed him along the street into an alley past the charred ruins of Jackson Bowen's church and back through a maze of shacks, smaller shanties, piles of human waste and debris, and even cardboard boxes that some people had fastened together to huddle in. They waded through a muddy, ankle-deep pool, and then went up a pair of wooden steps into a shack that was even smaller and draftier than Glory's. It only had one room, and as insulation, old newspaper and magazine pages had been nailed up all over the walls until there was no space not covered by yellowed headlines, type, and pictures from a dead world. Caden's wife, her face sallow in the light of the room's single lantern, held a sleeping infant in her thin arms. A boy, about 9 or 10 years old, frail and frightened-looking, clutched at his mother's legs and tried to hide when the strangers entered. The room held a couch with broken springs, an old crank-operated washing machine, and an electric stove, an antique, Josh thought, in which chips of wood, embers, and trash yielded a cheerless fire and little warmth. A wooden chair sat next to a pile of mattresses on the floor, where the eldest Caden boy lay under a coarse brown blanket. Swan approached the mattresses and looked down into the boy's face. Pieces of the Job's mask lay like broken gray pottery around his head, and she could see the slick, jelly-like stuff clinging to the inside of the fragments. The boy, his face white and his blue eyes still bright from fever, tried to sit up, but he was too weak. He pushed thick, dark hair back from his forehead.
"You're her, aren't you?" he asked. "The girl who started the corn growing?"
"Yes."
"That's really great. You can use corn a lot of different ways."
"I guess so."
Swan examined the boy's features. His skin was smooth and flawless, almost luminescent in the lantern's light. He had a strong square jawline and a thin bridged nose that was slightly sharp at the end. Overall, he was a handsome boy, and Swan knew he would grow up to be a handsome man if he survived. She couldn't understand what Caden had wanted her to see.
"Sure."
This time the boy did sit up, his eyes glittering and excited.
"You can fry it and boil it, make muffins and cakes, even squeeze oil out of it. You can make whiskey from it, too. I know all about it because I did a science project on corn back at my elementary school in Iowa. I won first prize at the state fair."
He paused, and then he touched the left side of his face with a trembling hand.
"What's happened to me?"
She looked over at Caden, who motioned for her, Josh, and sister to follow him outside. As Swan started to turn away from the mattresses, a headline on a newspaper plastered to the wall caught her eye.
"Arms talks crash as Star Wars gets a okay."
There was a photograph of important-looking men in suits and ties, smiling and lifting their hands in some kind of victory celebration. She didn't know what it was all about, because none of those men were familiar to her. They looked like very satisfied men, and their clothes looked clean and new, and their hair was perfectly in place. All of them were clean-shaven, and Swan wondered if any of them had ever squatted down over a bucket to use the bathroom. Then she went out to join the others.
"Your son's a fine-looking boy," sister was telling Caden. "You ought to be glad."
"I am glad. I'm thankful to God that stuff's off his face. But that's not the point."
"Okay, what is?"
"That's not my son's face. At least, that's not what he used to look like before he got that damned stuff on him."
"Swan's face was burned when the bombs hit," Josh said. "She doesn't look like she did then either."
"My son wasn't disfigured on the 17th of July,"
Caden replied calmly. He was hardly hurt at all. He's always been a good, fine boy, and his mother and I love him very much, but Ben was born with birth defects. He had a red birthmark that covered the entire left side of his face. The doctors called it a port wine stain, and his jaw was malformed. We had a specialist operate on him in Cedar Rapids, but the problem was so severe that, well, that there wasn't much to hope for. Still, Ben's always had guts. He wanted to go to a regular school and be treated like everybody else, no better or no worse. He looked at Swan. The color of his hair and eyes are the same as they always were. The shape of his face is the same. But the birthmark's gone. And his jaw isn't deformed anymore, and... He trailed off, shaking his head.
And what? Sister prompted.
He hesitated, trying to find the words, and then he lifted his gaze to hers. I used to tell him that real beauty is deeper than skin. I used to tell him that real beauty is what's inside, in the heart and soul. A tear trickled down Caden's right cheek. Now, Ben, it looks like I always knew he did, deep down inside. I think that now, the face of his soul is showing through. His own visage was stretched between laughing and crying. Is that a crazy thing to think?
No, Sister answered. I think it's a wonderful thing. He's a handsome boy. Always was,
Caden said, and this time he let himself smile. The man returned to his family, and the others walked back through the muddy maze to the road. They were quiet, each occupied by private thoughts. Josh and Sister reflecting on Caden's story, wondering if and when their own Job's masks might reach the point where they began to crack, and what might be revealed underneath. And Swan remembering something that Leona Skelton had told her a long time ago. Everybody's got two faces, child. The outside face and the inside face. A face under the face, you see. It's your true face, and if it was flipped to the outside, you'd show the world what kind of person you are.
Flipped to the outside, Swan recalled asking, how?
And Leona had smiled. Well, God hasn't figured a way to do that yet, but he will. The face of his soul is showing through, Mr. Caden had said.
But he will. Face of his soul, but he will.
Truck's coming in! Truck's coming!
Approaching along the road was a pickup truck, its sides and hood pitted with rust. It was coming at a crawl, and around it surged a tide of people hollering and laughing. Josh imagined it had been a long time since most of them had seen a car or truck that still actually ran. He put his hand on Swan's shoulder, and Sister stood behind them on the roadside as the truck rumbled toward them.
"Here she is, mister,"
a boy shouted, scrambling up onto the front fender and hood.
"She's right here."
The truck came to a stop, trailing a wake of people. Its engine sputtered, popped, and backfired. But the vehicle might have been a shiny new Cadillac from the way folks were rubbing the rust-eaten metal. The driver, a florid-faced man wearing a red baseball cap and clenching the stub of a real cigar between his teeth, looked warily out his window at the excited crowd, as if he wasn't quite sure what kind of madhouse he'd driven into.
"Swan's right here, mister,"
the boy on the hood said, pointing at her. He was talking to the man on the passenger side. The passenger's door opened, and a man with curly white hair and a long, untrimmed beard leaned out, craning his neck to see who the boy was pointing to. His dark brown eyes, set in a tough, wrinkled old face, searched the crowd.
"Where?" he asked. "I don't see her."
But Josh knew who the man had come to find. He raised his arm and said,
"Swan's over here, Sly."
Sylvester Moody recognized the huge wrestler from the traveling show and realized with a start exactly why he'd worn that black ski mask. His gaze moved to the girl who stood beside Josh, and for a moment, he couldn't speak.
"Sweet dancing Jesus," he finally exclaimed as he stepped out of the truck. He hesitated, still not sure it was her, glanced at Josh and saw him nod.
"Your face," Sly said, "it's all healed up."
"It happened a few nights ago," Swan told him, "and I think other people are starting to heal up too."
If the wind had been blowing any harder, he might have keeled flat over. "You're beautiful," he said. "Oh, Lord, you're beautiful."
He turned toward the truck and his voice quavered.
"Bill, this here's the girl. This is Swan."
Bill McHenry, Sly's nearest neighbor and owner of the truck, cautiously opened his door and got out.
"We had a hell of a time on that road," Sly complained. "One more bump and my ass would have busted. Lucky we brought along extra go juice or we'd have been walking the last 20 miles. He glanced around for someone else. "Where's the cowboy?"
"We buried Rusty a few days ago," Josh said. "He's in a field not too far from here."
"Oh," Sly frowned. "Well, I'm sorry to hear that." "I'm awful sorry. He seemed like a decent fella."
"He was."
Josh tilted his head, peering at the truck.
"What are you doing here?"
"I knew you folks were going to Mary's Rest. That's where you said you were headed when you left my place. I decided to come visit."
"Why? It's at least 50 miles of bad road between here and your house.
Don't my aching ass know it? God almighty, I'd like to sit on a nice soft pillow."
He rubbed his sore rump.
"It's no pleasure trip, that's for sure," Josh agreed. "But you knew that before you started. You didn't say why you came all that way."
"No," his eyes sparkled. "I don't reckon I did."
He gazed at the shacks of Mary's Rest.
"Lord, is this a town or a toilet? What's that awful smell?"
"You stay around long enough, you'll get used to it."
"Well, I'm just here for one day. One day's all I need to pay my debt."
"Debt? What debt?"
"What I owe Swan and you for bringing Swan to my door." "Throw it back, Bill."
And Bill McHenry, who'd gone around to the rear of the truck, pulled back a canvas tarpaulin that covered the truck's bed. It was piled full of small red apples, perhaps 200 or more of them. At the sight of the apples, there was a collective gasp that went back like a wave over the gathered onlookers. The smell of fresh apples sweetened the air. Sly started laughing, laughing fit to bust, and then he climbed up into the truck's bed and picked up a shovel that was lying there.
"I brought you some apples from my tree, Swan,"
Sly yelled, his face split by a smile.
"Where do you want them?"
She didn't know what to say. She'd never seen so many apples outside of a supermarket before. They were bright red, and each one about the size of a boy's fist. She just stood staring at them, and she figured she must look like a dumb fool. But then she knew where she wanted the apples to go.
"Out there," she said, and she pointed to the people crowding around the tailgate. Sly nodded.
"Yes, ma'am," he said.
And then he dug the shovel into the pile of apples and let them fly over the heads of the crowd. Apples rained from the sky, and the starving people of Mary's Rest snatched them as they fell. Apples bounced off their heads, shoulders, and backs, but no one cared. There was a roar of voices as other people ran from the alleys and shacks to grab an apple. And they were dancing in the showers of apples, capering and hollering and clapping their hands. Sly Moody's shovel kept working as more and more people came flooding out of the alleys. But there was no fighting for the precious delicacies. Everyone was too intent on getting an apple. And as Sly Moody kept throwing them into the air, the pile hardly seemed to have dented. Sly grinned deliriously, and he wanted to tell Swan that 2 days before, he'd awakened to find his tree burdened down with hundreds of apples, the branches dragging on the ground. and as soon as those were picked, there were already new buds bursting open, and the whole incredibly short cycle was going to be repeated. It was the most amazing, miraculous thing he'd ever seen in his life, and that single tree looked healthy enough to produce hundreds more apples, maybe thousands. He and Carla had already filled their buckets to overflowing. Every time Sly's shovel tossed the apples, there was a roar of whooping and laughing. The crowd surged in all directions as apples bounced off them and rolled on the ground. Swan, Sister, and Josh were jostled and pushed apart, and suddenly Swan felt herself being carried along with the crowd's momentum like a reed in a river. "Swan!" she heard Sister shout, but she was already at least 30 feet from Sister, and Josh was doing his best to plow through the people without hurting anyone. An apple hit Swan's shoulder, fell to the ground in front of her, and rolled a few feet. She bent to pick it up before she was swept away again, and as her fingers closed on it, someone in a pair of scuffed brown boots stepped to within 3 feet of her. She felt cold, a gnawing, bone-aching cold, and she knew who it was. Her heart hammered. Panic skittered up her spine. The man in the brown boots did not move. And people were not jostling him. They avoided him as if repelled by the cold. Apples continued to fall to the ground and the crowd surged, but nobody picked up the apples that lay between Swan and the man who watched her. Her first almost overwhelming impulse was to cry for help from Josh or Sister, but she knew he expected that. As soon as she stood up and opened her mouth, the burning hand would be on her throat. She didn't know exactly what she was going to do, but she was so scared she was about to wet herself. And then she clenched her teeth and slowly, gracefully, stood up with the apple gripped in her hand. She looked at him because she wanted to see the face of the man with the scarlet eye. He was wearing the mask of a skinny black man, wearing jeans and a Boston Celtics t-shirt under an olive-green coat. A red scarf was wrapped around his neck, and his piercing, terrible eyes were pale amber. Their stares locked, and Swan saw a silver tooth flash in the front of his mouth when he grinned. Sister was too far away. Josh was still fighting the crowd. The man with the scarlet eye stood 3 feet away. And to Swan it seemed that everyone was swirling around them in nightmarish slow motion, that she and the man stood alone in a trance of time. She knew she must decide her own fate because there was no one else to help her. And she was aware of something else in the eyes of the mask he was wearing, something beyond the cold, lizard-like sheen of evil, something deeper and almost human. She remembered seeing the same thing in the eyes of Uncle Tommy the night he'd crushed her flowers back in the Kansas trailer park 7 years ago. It was something wandering and longing, forever locked away from the light and maddened like a tiger in a dark cage. It was dumb arrogance and bastard pride, stupidity and rage stoked to atomic power. But it was something of a little boy, too, wailing and lost. Swan knew him, knew what he'd done and what he would do. And in that moment of knowledge, she lifted her arm, reached out her hand toward him, and offered him the apple. "I forgive you," she said. His grin went crooked, like the reflection in a mirror abruptly shattered. He blinked uncertainly, and in his eyes Swan saw fire and savagery, a core of pain past human suffering, and so furious that it almost ripped her own heart to shreds. He was a scream wrapped up in straw, a little, weak, vicious thing, gnashing inside a monstrous facade. She saw what he was made of, and she knew him very well. "Take it," she told him, and her heart was beating wildly. But she knew he'd be on her at the first smell of fear.
It's time.
The grin faded. His eyes ticked from her face to the apple and back again like a deadly metronome.
Take it,
she urged, the blood pounding so hard in her head she couldn't hear herself. He stared into her eyes, and Swan felt him probe her mind like a freezing ice pick. Little cuts here and there, and then a dark examination of her memories. It was as if every moment of her life was being invaded, picked up and soiled with dirty hands, tossed aside. But she kept her gaze steady and strong, and she would not retreat before him. The apple snagged his attention again, and the cold ice pick jabbing within Swan's mind ceased. She saw his eyes glaze over and his mouth open, and from that mouth crawled a green fly that weakly spun around her head and fell into the mud. His hand began to rise, slowly, very slowly. Swan didn't look at it, but she sensed it rising like the head of a cobra. She was waiting for it to burst into flame, but it didn't. His fingers strained for the apple, and Swan saw that his hand was trembling. He almost took it. Almost. His other hand shot out and grabbed his own wrist, wrenched his arm back, and pinned the offending hand underneath his chin. He made a gasping, moaning noise that sounded like wind through the battlements of Hell's castles, and his eyes almost bulged from his skull. He shrank backward from Swan, his teeth gritted in a snarl, and for an instant he lost control, one eye bleached to blue and white pigment streaked across the ebony flesh. A second mouth, full of shiny white nubs, gaped like a scar across his right cheekbone. In his eyes was hatred and fury and longing for what could never be. He turned and fled, and with his first running stride, the trance of time broke and the crowd was whirling around Swan again, grabbing up the last of the apples. Josh was just a few feet away, trying to get through to protect her, but it was all right now, she knew. She needed no more protection. Someone else plucked the apple from her hand. She looked into Robin's face.
I hope this one's for me, he said,
and he smiled before he bit into it. He ran through the muddy alleys of Mary's Rest with his hand trapped beneath his chin, and where he was going he didn't know. The hand tensed and shivered, as if trying to fight free of a will of its own. Dogs scattered out of his path, and then he tripped over debris and went down in the mud, got up and staggered on again. And if anyone had seen his face, they would have witnessed 1,000 transformations. Too late, he screamed inwardly. Too late, too late. He'd planned to set her afire right there in the midst of them and laugh as he watched her dance. But he'd looked into her eyes and seen forgiveness, and he could not stand up to such a thing. Forgiveness, even for him. He'd started to take the apple for a brief instant. He'd wanted it. Like taking the first step along a dark corridor that led back to light. But then the rage and pain had flared within him, and he'd felt the very walls of the universe warp and the wheels of time start to clog and lock. Too late. Too late. But he needed no one and nothing to survive, he told himself. He had endured and would endure, and this was his party now. He had always walked alone, always walked alone, always walked. A scream echoed from the edge of Mary's Rest, and those who heard it thought it sounded like someone being flayed alive. But most of the people were busy collecting apples, shouting and laughing as they ate, and they did not hear. Chapter 71. A ring of torches lit the night, burning around the perimeter of a huge parking lot 15 miles south of the ruins of Lincoln, Nebraska.
At the center of the parking lot was a complex of brick buildings connected by sheltered walkways and with skylights and ventilators set in their flat roofs. In the side of one of the buildings that faced Highway 77 South were rusted metal letters that read, Green Bry R. Shop in Mall. On the western edge of the parking lot, a Jeep's lights flashed twice. About 20 seconds later, there was an answering double flash of headlights from a pickup truck with an armored windshield parked near one of the entrances to the mall. There's the signal, Roland Croninger said. Let's go. Judd Lowry drove the Jeep slowly across the parking lot, aiming at the headlights that grew closer as the pickup truck approached. The tires jarred roughly over bricks, pieces of metal, old bones, and other debris that littered the snow-slick concrete. In the seat behind Roland was a soldier with an automatic rifle, and Lowry wore a .38 in a shoulder holster. But Roland was unarmed. He watched the range between the two vehicles steadily decrease. Both the Jeep and the truck were flying white pieces of cloth from their radio antennas.
They'll never let you out of there alive, Lowry said almost casually.
He glanced quickly over at Captain Croninger's bandage-wrapped face, cowled by the hood of his coat.
Why'd you volunteer for this?
The cowled face slowly swiveled toward Lowry.
I like excitement.
Yeah, well, you're about to get it, sir.
Lowry negotiated the Jeep past the hulk of a burned-out car and tapped the brakes. The pickup truck was about 50 feet away and beginning to slow down. The vehicles stopped 30 feet apart. There was no movement from the truck.
We're waiting,
Roland shouted out his window, his breath steaming through his gnarled lips. The seconds ticked past with no response, and then the passenger door opened, and a blonde man wearing a dark blue parka, brown trousers, and boots got out. He stepped a few paces away from the door and leveled a shotgun at the Jeep's windshield.
Steady,
Roland cautioned as Lowry started to reach for his .38. Another man got out of the truck and stood beside the first. He was slight and had close-cropped dark hair, and he lifted his hands to show he was unarmed.
Okay, the one with the shotgun shouted, getting edgy. Let's make the trade.
Roland was afraid, but he'd learned long before how to push the child Roland away and summon forth the Sir Roland in himself. The adventurer in service to the king's will be done, amen. His palms were wet inside his black gloves, but he opened the door and got out. The soldier with the automatic rifle followed him and stood off to the side a few feet, aiming at the other armed man. Roland glanced back at Lowry, making sure the fool wasn't going to fuck this up, and then he began walking to the truck. The dark-haired man started walking to the Jeep, his eyes darting and nervous. The two figures passed, neither one looking at the other, and the man with the shotgun grabbed Roland's arm about the same time as the AOE soldier pushed his captive against the Jeep's side. Roland was made to lean against the truck, spread his arms and legs, and submit to a search. When it was over, the man spun him around and pressed the snout of the shotgun underneath his chin.
What's wrong with your face?
The man demanded. What's under those bandages?
I was burned pretty bad, Roland answered. That's all. I don't like it.
The man had lank, thinning blonde hair and fierce blue eyes, like a maniac surfer boy.
Imperfection is Satan's work. Praise the Savior. The trade's been done, Roland said.
The American Allegiance hostage was already being shoved into the Jeep.
The Savior's waiting for me.
The man paused, jittery and uncertain, and then Lowry began to back the Jeep up, clinching the deal. Roland didn't know if that was smart or stupid.
Get in.
The American Allegiance soldier hustled him into the truck's cab. where Roland sat squeezed between him and the heavy-set, black-bearded driver. The truck veered across the parking lot and turned back toward the mall. Through the narrow view slit in the armored windshield, Roland saw the headlights pick out more vehicles protecting the American Allegiance's fortress. An armored truck with Brinks still barely legible on its side, a Jeep with a mounted machine gun in the rear seat, a tractor-trailer rig with dozens of gun ports, each showing a rifle or machine gun barrel, cut into the long metal trailer. A postman's truck with a metal mesh turret on top, more cars and trucks, and then the vehicle that put a lump like a hen's egg in Roland's throat. A low-slung, wicked-looking tank, covered with multicolored graffiti that said things like, "The Love Bug" and "The Savior Lives." The tank's main cannon, Roland noted, was aimed in the general direction of Colonel Macklin's Airstream trailer, where the King was now incapacitated, suffering from a fever that had struck him down the previous night. The truck passed between the tank and another armored car, went over the curb, and continued up a ramp for the handicapped, entering the mall through the dark open space where glass doors had once been. The headlights illuminated a wide central mall area with stores on either side that had been looted and wrecked a long time before. Soldiers with rifles, pistols, and shotguns waved the truck on, and hundreds of lanterns were burning in the central corridor and in the stores, casting a flickering orange glow like the light at a Halloween party throughout the building. And Roland saw hundreds of tents set up as well, cramped into every possible space except for a path along which the truck traveled. Roland realized that the whole American Allegiance had set up camp inside the shopping mall, and as the truck turned into a larger, skylighted atrium, he heard singing and saw the glare of a fire. Perhaps 1,000 people were jammed into the atrium, clapping their hands rhythmically, singing and swaying around a large campfire, the smoke whirling up through the skylight's broken glass. Almost all of them had rifles slung over their shoulders, and Roland knew that one reason the Savior had invited an AOE officer here was to display his weapons and troops. But the reason Roland had accepted the courier's invitation was to find a weak spot in the Savior's fortress. The truck didn't enter the atrium, but continued along another corridor that branched off from it, again lined with looted stores now filled with tents, drums of gasoline and oil, what looked like cases of canned food and bottled water, clothes, weapons, and other supplies. The truck stopped in front of a store, and the blonde man with the shotgun got out and motioned for Roland to follow. Roland saw the broken fragments of a sign that had once said, "B. Dalton Booksellers," over the entrance before he walked into the store. Three lanterns burned on the cashier's desk, where both registers had been battered into junk. The walls of the store were scorched, and Roland's boots crunched over the skeletons of charred books. Not a volume remained on the shelves or display tables. Everything had been piled up and set afire. More lanterns glowed back at the store's information desk, and the man with the shotgun pushed Roland toward the closed door of the stockroom, where another American Allegiance soldier with an automatic rifle stood at attention. As Roland approached, the soldier lowered his rifle and clicked the safety off. "Halt," he said. Roland stopped. The soldier rapped on the door. A short, bald man with narrow, fox-like features peered out. He smiled warmly. "Hello there. He's almost ready to see you. He wants to know your name." "Roland Croninger." The man pulled his head back into the room and closed the door again. Then, abruptly, it opened and the bald man asked, "Are you Jewish?"
"No."
And then the hood of Roland's coat was yanked back. "Look," the man with the shotgun said.
"Tell 'em they sent us somebody with a disease."
Oh dear."
The other one looked fretfully at Roland's bandaged face.
"What's wrong with you, Roland?"
"I was burned," back on the seven.
He's a fork-tongued liar, Brother Norman.
The shotgun's barrel pressed against the hard growths on Roland's skull.
He's got the Satan leprosy.
Brother Norman frowned and made a clicking sound.